Good evening. It's a pleasure again to have everyone here. Welcome to our third class in the series of the history of the Hasidic Masters. I want to thank Dr. Dauer for sponsoring tonight's class. May Hashem bless you with abundance and good health. And you should bring a lot of refuah to a lot of people. And soon there should only be, shouldn't be anybody to heal, because everybody will be gesund und stark, and you should go on to healing, or like the Rebbe would say, preventive medicine. Thank you. Where tonight's class, the subject is Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Bala Tanya. This class particularly so cherished because from this podium over here, and I teach his teachings of the Bala Tanya for hours and hours every week. So you have a special energy in regards to this particular tzaddik and master and teacher. Thank you, Rabbi Lieberman, again.
I hope this is working, and I hope it's at the right height. And if not, please let me know where, what, how, and when. So tonight's, call it lecture, shiur, lesson, is a little bit of, how should I put this? Certain things are easy, some things are very difficult, and some things are confusing. To speak of the Bala Tanya is a challenge, two, superficially very easy. To get in a little bit of depth, it becomes very hard, and at some point, if you're not paying attention, it gets confusing. Having said that, I want to start with a statement that you've heard me make a few times. Once the Baal Shem Tov came around and that wellspring was opened up, so let me put that on the thinking block and let's go somewhere else. In our history, when great people come along, they cause an unbelievable revolution, almost like an earthquake in a spiritual kind of a sense, and we suddenly... So let me give you an example. When Rashi comes around, Rashi's contribution to our world of Torah is absolutely... You can't measure it. Because from the time Rashi wrote his commentary, both to the Chumash and to the Gemara, there hasn't been a day. Not an hour, and probably not a second, when somewhere in the world is learning Rashi. Rashi caused a revolution where Rashi's grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their Talmidim, the Balei Tosvos, start a whole new enterprise, and that enterprise revolutionized all of learning. And it goes on to this day. It hasn't stopped. Just give you a simple example. You can take any Rashi, literally, any Rashi in Chumash, and if you want to learn the commentaries on that Rashi, today printed, forget what's maybe left in manuscripts and maybe one day will be printed, Rashi has close to 400 commentaries written to him. And the 400 commentaries don't all agree. So you can take one Rashi, and then take 400 commentaries from the famous ones like the Mizrahi and the Gurariye and the Maskil of David, and closer to our time, the Rebbe himself wrote Biurim and Perushim to Rashi. Put Rashi in the background for a minute. Comes the Rambam. Comes along the Rambam. What does the Rambam do? Takes all of Torah Shebal Peh, literally. All of Chazal, and I mean all of Chazal. Bavli, Yerushalmi, Tosefta, Sifrei, Sifra, Mechilta, reformulates it in a whole new different way. Until the Rambam, everybody learned the Gemara. After the Gemara, they learned the Rif. Rif came along and he made the Gemara shorter. He was Makatza the Gemara. In fact, the Rif was called the Talmud HaKaton, the small Gemara. And the Rambam said, no, I'm going to reformulate all this. I'm going to give it back to you. It's almost like the Rambam internalizes all of Torah Shebaal Peh's brain, works out every single machlokus in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, in Tanoim Amoraim, adds to it the latest cases, and somehow this thing called the Mishnah Torah comes out in a new order, not the order of the Gemara. And every halacha follows. And immediately everyone jumped in, and the Ravid right away, who argued, said that Ozav ha-mechaber hazeh derech kol ha-mechaberim, what the Rambam did, no one else did before. He doesn't cite a source. How could you do that? He doesn't tell us how he reached his conclusion. And halacha, how do you do that? Criticism after criticism, even with the fear that because people might follow the Rambam in learning, no one will learn Gemara anymore. Because the Rambam himself said, quite assuredly, learn all of Torah Shebiksav, and after that, you need nothing else except for my book, says the Rambam. Read all of Tanakh first, and then you read in my Sefer, and after that, you need nothing else. And everyone got so nervous that the learning would now stop. But just the opposite happened. The total opposite happened. Because the Rambam didn't tell us, not the source and not how he got, everyone jumped in and relearned everything all over again to see. So the Rambam causes a revolution. And this is the way we go. Comes along the Baal Shem Tov. And notice so far, in the tiny little Sfarim that we've mentioned, it's a revolution for the Noam Elimelech and some of the other Sfarim, or the Toldos Yaakov Yosef. You meet this one person, the Baal Shem Tov. You meet his main student, who is the proponent of this new derech called Hasidus, Dov Ber of Mezrich. But everyone who comes in contact with them walks away and creates a work that to this day remains as solid as it was on the day it left that first publishing house that printed it. So to speak of what we call the Admar HaZokain, the Alter Rebbe, the titles have no end. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav, or Shneur Zalman Miliadi. This one tiny book, forget about the other stuff which we'll speak about, 200 years ago, not only has it revolutionized the world, but it stands as a monument to what Hasidus created. So let's try to figure out what and how did all this happen? So now let me go somewhere else. Imagine, maybe more to the men with this question than to the women, because in those days it was slightly different, but imagine any one of us in this room. The year is somewhere in the 1700s, and you want to go and learn. You love learning. Where should you go? To pose the question in a modern sense is very dangerous. So I'm not going to mention the name of any yeshiva at all, not on this side, not on that side, not up, not down, not left, not right, because we'll stay clean of politics. But if someone loves learning today, real learning, which yeshiva would he go to today? And we could argue. He goes to that one, goes to this one. How do you choose where to go? So a bacher wants to really, to use the Yiddish, wants to steig, he wants to really master learning, and he wants to learn with the greatest of teachers, the greatest Rosh Yeshiva, the greatest Magid Shir, the greatest Rebbe, the greatest, where is he going to go? So there are places. Some are very hard to get into, some you need connections, etc., etc. In the 1700s, let's say 1750, 1760 roughly, the Baal HaTanya was born in 1745. The Baal Shem Tov is still around. Where should one go to yeshiva? Let's remind ourselves that in the 1700s, the Baal Shem Tov is out there. Suddenly, there's a new derech, there's a new yeshiva, there's a new way of learning. So where should I go? Even as far as, call it, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, all the way into the depths of what we call White Russia, Lithuania. Everyone in the 1700s heard of one name, the Gaon of Vilna. If you're anything at all, you'd pick yourself up, travel to Vilna, and somehow, if you were lucky, you might get in to a lesson or two if you were allowed. If you'd go through 50 gates, you'd become a student of the Gaon of Vilna. And if you merited to spend a couple of hours with him, you called yourself Talmido Shel HaGaon HaChassid Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, and you were something. At the same time, in this particular time period, you can go somewhere else. You can go to Mezrich, where everyone suddenly, it's a different place. So where would one go? And you have people who went to both. And people who switched, who went to Mezrich and weren't happy, went to Vilna. And there were people who went to Vilna and weren't happy, and Vilna went to Mezrich. So this person, if we can call him a person, Shneur Zalman of Liadi, where should he go? He's not sure. Chassidus hasn't hit. His father was not a Chassid. Very few people call themselves Chassidim in 1760. So where should he go? The Gaon of Vilna is in Vilna, and everyone is running there. Dov Ber is in Mezrich. The Baal Shem Tov is not kind of easy to get to, but through Dov Ber you can get to the Baal Shem Tov. So where would you go? And history will change on the choice you make. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi is confused, doesn't know where to go. The difference in learning between Vilna and Mezrich, if we can put it out there in simple terminology, would be the brain, the mind, and the heart. The Gaon of Vilna, the greatest intellectual in the Jewish world of learning in this particular time period, is absolutely, totally about learning. Every single minute, every single second has to be spent learning and using your mind to delve deeply into every single aspect of learning. You have to master every page of Gemara, every word, every argument has to make sense, and you have to work it through. In Mezrich, it was not the mind. It was the heart. Which do you want to develop? So, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who's really at this point not of Liadi, he was of a place called Liozna, where he spent most of his life. Liadi's only at the end of his life, and that's how it gets upheld to the title of his name. He's not sure. Gets married to a wonderful family, people who are very well off. And he clearly is what we call a person of stature from the earliest of days. In our history of great people, sometimes these things are exaggerated, and of course everyone knew Shas at the age of 5. By the age of 14, they knew let's get real. There were such people, but not everyone was like that. But he was one of those. His bar mitzvah shetel, if you want, or discussion, or call it a maimar by later terminology, had to do with the intricate laws of Kiddush HaChodesh. The intricate laws of the Levana and details where the Rambam wrote an entire section called Kiddush HaChodesh, and to this day people learn to try to figure out what's going on. So at the age of 13, in front of everyone in Liozna, he darshans, and people look at this 13-year-old and say, he's going to be something. In the next few years, his learning is very deep. He masters the Gemara, and now he has to make a choice. And he's torn. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes to Mezrich. There are interesting stories which are really accurate and not. Who knows? Like everyone, predictions were made about this child before he was even born. Okay, we don't know that. But lo and behold, he comes to Mezrich, and he sits and learns with the great Magid. And by the way, he never sees the Baal Shem Tov. Interesting, the story is the Baal Shem Tov actually said, he's for the next generation, I don't even want to see him. And he doesn't know. After a while, he said, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should go to Vilna. So he's here for about 3 years, and maybe it's time to leave. So what Reb Shneur Zalman does, he goes to the Magid and says, look, I've been here for a while. I'm not so sure that I've been matzliach here. I think I'm going to try something else. And of course, he wishes him well. Bracha v'atzlacha, go on. But do me one favor, said the Magid, before you go, say goodbye to my son, who's known as the Malach, Avram, the son of well, actually later becomes the Chavrusa with him. And he tells him, go say goodbye to my son, the Malach. And of course, Reb Shneur Zalman goes to the Malach and he says, you know, I'm not really matzliach here, it's nice knowing you, and maybe you want to walk me to the Balagola and, you know, like walk me to the train station, walk me to the subway, whatever it is that they used in those days. And the Malach tells him, oh, have a safe journey. But when you're sitting in the wagon, just watch the horses, and you'll see something fascinating, he tells him. Look at the driver, the Balagola, who takes a whip. And what he does with that whip is he hits those horses, and every time that whip's about to hit the horse starts going quicker. Because the horse is afraid that another whip is coming. The horse doesn't turn around to see. In fact, the horse knows the whip is coming, and like, let me run, because maybe I'll run ahead, because they're so smart. I'll run ahead of the whip, and I'll miss the whip. So I'm going to run faster so the whip will not reach me. But, says the Malach to Reb Shneur Zalman, a Baal Seichel, a human being that has a mind, looks back. He looks back, and by looking back, he sees who's hitting him. And he got the message right away. He never left. He turned around and understood that when those things come in life, there's a master of the world, and the master has a plan. And in life, there are good times, and sometimes you get hit, and you have to know who's hitting you, and you have to figure out why you're being hit. That hit him in the heart, and years later, he would say that he came to Mezrich not for the mind he had. He came to figure out his heart. Total opposite of what he would have gotten back in Vilna. So he stays here for a while. He learns. About 3 years after that, he leaves, goes back to Liozna, where he becomes the Magid. He's in his 20s. Imagine. He's about 23, 24. He's the Magid, a 23-year-old. Imagine a person who clearly has mastered what there is to master in all of Torah Shebaal Peh. In fact, the Magid tells him, you know what you should start to do? You should rewrite the Shulchan Aruch. And he begins to write what eventually becomes the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the classic great Shulchan Aruch, that becomes the source of everything that follows in Halacha afterwards. To this day, I mean, the minute you learn Mishnah Berurah, everyone's learning Mishnah Berurah today. Just look around. Here and there is the Admor HaZokain being quoted. But imagine when someone is able in his 20s to already reformulate a classic. The Shulchan Aruch was out there. It caused its own revolution, the same way Rashi caused the revolution, the same way the Rambam caused the revolution. The Shulchan Aruch caused the revolution. Just open up a Shulchan Aruch. Look at the commentaries. And here comes Reb Shneur Zalman with depth and understanding and beautiful language and clarity and reformulates it in a way where it becomes more understood by the simple person. Because by now the commentaries have grown. He's able to reformulate them, re-evaluate them. The Rabbanon, the Oraisa, this one, who do we Paschalite? Do we Mekel here? Are we Machmir here? And he writes the Shulchan Aruch. Historians make a big deal out of the Shulchan Aruch because the way they understand it is that the reason he was told to write the Shulchan Aruch is because there was great criticism already, because we're now literally in the midst of the first war between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. And one of the charges against the Hasidim was that they're not keeping halacha. They're not learning halacha. They're not learned at all. They're all Amei Haaretz. And supposedly, the Magid told them, go ahead and write the Shulchan Aruch. Sadly, much of it has been lost. We do not have the complete manuscripts of what would have been a full Shulchan Aruch Harav. There was a fire that destroyed, and we don't have it. But if you want to, like, ever learn it well, look at the laws of Talmud Torah in the Shulchan Aruch Harav, and that has become classic. The laws of how one should learn Torah, what is Torah, what is the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and that becomes huge. He has so well imbued the Derech HaChassidus that he now begins to travel out of Liozna to some of the cities in this part of the world. And you know, we as Jews are very sophisticated people. With Yom Kshei Oref, we have a question about everything. You know, the joke goes, there's three Jews, you have 16 questions, right? Every town, literally every town in the Jewish world had one or two Hasidim, one or two Misnagdim, who were very vocal. Who are you? What is this new Derech? Or just the opposite? Who says your Derech is valid? And the truth is, we're like that to this day. Look at our young generation. When Pesach is now coming, everyone's coming home from different places that they were learning. My Rebbe is better than your Rebbe. My Rebbe is a greater tzaddik than your Rebbe. My Rebbe knows more than your Rebbe. Well, how do you know? So let's argue about it. And we've done this from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hasn't changed. We're very good at this. We make life difficult for ourselves because we're that sophisticated, Baruch Hashem. So Reb Shneur Zalman finds himself in cities where he has to defend this new way of Hasidus. And because he's so learned, because he's very soft-spoken, he's able to win not only the arguments, but he becomes the spokesperson for this particular new way of Hasidus. Somewhere around 1772, 73, the Gaon of Vilna is convinced by people around him that this movement of Hasidus is dangerous. It smacks maybe of Shabtai Tzvi, where people are breaking halacha. The Hasidim are not davening on time. They've forgotten about what they call Zmanei HaTfilah, etc., etc. A whole bunch of things, not important. But in Vilna, in the city of Brod, Hasidim are placed in Cherem, signed with the signature of the Gaon of Vilna. They are not to be spoken to. They are not allowed to come into shul. They are not to count for a minyan because they are following this new derech, which is not a derech. It's a mistaken road called Hasidus. What's interesting is that the Gaon of Vilna himself, before the movement of Hasidism has, so to say, resurfaced again, was called a Chassid. That's always a Gaon HaChassid, Rabbeinu Eliyahu. This Rabbeinu Eliyahu has put the Hasidim in Cherem. That I can clearly tell you that there were physical fights between Hasidim and Misnagdim, there definitely were. That the language is of what we call maybe foul language was used on both sides against each other by people who were not that learned, and some of the documents have survived, and it's not something that we're very proud of. But at the end of the day, for the main people who are in the midst of this argument, is clearly what we call an argument l'shem shamayim. Each one felt that their way of serving Hashem was absolutely correct. Somewhere in this time period, and we can't pinpoint it exactly, Rav Shneur Zalman begins to formulate in his head, call it a theology, call it a hashkafa, call it an ideology of trying to figure out what and where between these two points is what you call the Nekudas HaEmes. Where is the truth here? Call it subjective truth if you want, but let's look at all the sources. Let's try to figure it all out. Is there a way to make all this work? Because he is so learned, he is actually asked by the Magid to go to Vilna in 1774 and meet with the Gaon of Vilna, together with Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, and convince the Gaon to remove the cherem that was placed on Hasidim. So Rav Shneur Zalman comes to Vilna, and they knock on the door of the Gaon, and here the narratives vary slightly. Bottom line is, he does not want to see them, and said goodbye. He told the shamis, please tell them to leave, or the door was opened a little bit, and whatever it is, at the end of the day, it was not like, please come in, let's sit down, let's have a little schnapsel and figure out what this is all about. Out. Later on, Rav Shneur Zalman will write and say that the differences between Hasidim and Misnagdim were so huge that there was no room for compromise. Why exactly the Gaon of Vilna didn't want to see these two great Chachamim remains a matter of debate amongst historians. The family of Soloveitchik, the Briskers, have different traditions. The last Rav Soloveitchik, the Yosha Ber, said that there was a family tradition that the Gaon was actually afraid that if he would listen, he might have been convinced of the truth of whatever this movement was. He just didn't want to go there. Others say that absolutely not. The Gaon of Vilna would no way, shape, or form waste his time with this kind of... Now, how much he actually knew of what this Derech HaChassidus was, it's hard to tell. Is it based only on what people told him? Because at the end of the day, the Gaon of Vilna, if you remember, did not waste a second. Here's a man who hardly slept, who had no time for anything except learning. His hours were, if you look at them, almost frightening. There are descriptions of him with his feet in water as nighttime came, so he should not fall asleep, God forbid, learning. If he slept more than 2 hours within 24 hours, that is already a lot. That he hardly spoke to his family. And I'm not justifying it or not, and it's a whole different discussion of, like, if you're really into the methodology of learning day and night, can you ignore your family? Is the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is so huge that you're not mevatel it for anything? But there's that great story that's documented where the Gaon of Vilna did not see his sister for over 52 years, and she came to Vilna to see him, and the Gaon sent a message, tell her that my beard is gray, and I do not know how much more time I have left in this world, and I wish her well. But I'm not coming to say hello, because I know that if I do, I'm going to get in discussion, how's this one doing, how's that doing, it's going to be like hours of like mishpacha talk, and like I have something to do. I have to learn. So here are these two different understandings of what's going on. In the interim, Rav Shneur Zalman travels, participates in a huge debate about this new derech in Minsk, and he wins the debate, hands down. And by now, the Hasidic movement, it's on its way. There's no way to stop it. A rumor is spread in the 1780s that the Gaon of Vilna has removed this cheirim, which was not true. They come and actually tell the Gaon of Vilna, there's people said you removed your cheirim. Chas v'shalom. In fact, you know what? I'll put them in cheirim again. And a second cheirim is issued from Vilna against the Hasidic movement. But by now, Rav Shneur Zalman has thought a lot. He has argued a lot. And he begins to understand something in a way which will make him unique and forever will change the history of us as a people. He is able to understand that the mind has a purpose and the heart has a purpose. And up until this point, if you study Jewish philosophy, you'll see great philosophers who clearly went only to the mind. Take the Rambam, take the Ralbag. Clearly, it's an intellectual, it's the mind that's most important. How do you serve Hashem on your highest level? By taking the greatest gift that Hashem has given us, which is the Seichel, and use the Seichel to understand me, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Figure it out. On the other side of the spectrum, you had books like the Chovos HaLevavos and similar ones, eventually the Mesilas Yesharim, which clearly reached the heart. It's the Chovos HaLevavos that you got to figure out. The mitzvos and the mind, that's okay, very nice. But if deep inside here you don't have not only the right values, but the right focus with the heart, then you miss the point. So at the end of the day, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want? Does he want the mind? Does he want the heart? And what Rav Shneur Zalman is able to do, and this is the chiddush of the entire Tanya in a split second, it's a combination of both. You need the mind, and you need the heart. And the line that's so most oft quoted in his name is that the moach is sholet al halev. The shlita on the lev is the mind. You can't have just the mind and you can't have just the heart. It's a combination, it's a tension, it's a struggle, but it's both the mind and the heart. And this tiny little book, which when you look at it like, okay, this is kind of huge, but if you take away the translation and the footnotes, the book at the end of the day is a tiny book. It's actually five different things that somehow amalgamate together to make the Tanya. But having thought about this, to him, let's figure this out. How do I get the mind and how do I get the heart and develop both to their potential to make every single person, and he'll say this straight out, and this is where he differs, everyone can be the tzaddik. The philosophy of the Tanya is not for the people with the yichus. It's not the Rosh Yeshiva who passes it on to, you have to be worthy of it, but everyone can be worthy of it. Every single person. He begins to think about this, and eventually he writes this down a little kunteresim, a little books, and the people who follow him copy out what he has written. And the Tanya is actually floating around in handwritten copies before it becomes actually published in 1797, when finally it comes out. And not in the way we have it today, because the last two parts of the Tanya were added about 1814, and when it becomes with these all these five parts to make up the Tanya. But its beauty is that it grabs the reader immediately. Because if you remember it, anybody here know it by heart, how those first two prakim immediately grab you in. I should tell you that I was 16 years old, and by then, of course, having heard of Chabad, because the Rebbe was on the radio, and I got to stay up late. Because hey, got to go to sleep. But no, my dear parents, on WEVD, if you remember, the Rebbe's Farbrengen was broadcast, and the Rebbe went for hours so I could stay up. It was good entertainment. And then in the summer, when I was 16 years old, this is personal, and it had a huge impact, I spent the summer in a very popular, good boys' camp up in the Catskills. And then one Friday night, and then that summer I think I was a waiter, that one Friday night we heard that another camp down the road, this was in the city of Lac Sheldrake, down the road there was another camp that just moved in. And we asked, which camp is there? Oh, it's a Chabad camp. What's the name of the camp? Oh, it's called Hadar HaTorah. And Rabbi J.J. Hecht comes with all these interesting people. So Friday night, okay, we serve whatever. Let's go down the road to see this camp of Chabad people. And we come, all these young, cool, youngsters. If you remember those days, there was something called bell bottoms. We're cool. Let's see who's next door. These cool Chabad people. It was a learning camp. And we all sit down. Hey, Shalom Aleichem, Good Shabbos. Who are you? So what they all said to us, sit down and learn with us. So what are you, crazy? It's summer. We're on vacation. We have a shir in the camp for an hour, Gemara. We're done. Besides, it's Shabbos now. Tomorrow morning they'll force us to learn. What do you guys want to learn? To sit down. And every one of us was isolated. And Lieberman, sit down. And for the first time in my life, this fellow opens up to Tanya. I heard of it, but that's a book. Who knows? Whatever. There's lots of books. Who cares about books? And this fellow says to me, let's learn it. And wow. 3 o'clock at night. We said, I think we better get back to camp. They're probably looking for us. We're going to send out. We're Friday night, the entire staff at the kitchen is not coming back. Who's going to serve the next meal on Shabbos? It blew us away. And every Friday night we came back to learn more. Because the Tanya has that flavor of think about it. And to develop this idea of tzaddik for Ralo, tzaddik for Tovlo, and the idea of a Beinoni, there's this person in between, and we should all strive to be this Beinoni. Because, wow. And that there's a nefesh habahamis, and there's a nefesh, and what is all this? The Rebbe never told me this in yeshiva. So that summer, of course, we all went back to our different yeshivas, and we said, hey, can we learn this book? No, that's not for you. That's only for Chabad. And of course, when you tell someone it's not for you, the first thing you do, so I went out, and I bought myself an English translation, a little bit bigger than this, and I didn't understand a word of what I learned myself. So you go back and you ask someone. And this book becomes literally the Torah Shebiksav of Chabad. Imagine a man who is able to write one book that is still studied to this day as intently as ever, if not more, with commentaries written to it. Recently, I had the privilege of speaking about the Haggadah Shel Pesach. And since I love books, I always try to check how many Haggadahs have been printed from the beginning of time till today. Any guess? So it's about between 3,000 and 4,000 Haggadahs have been printed in the world. Forget about the fact that the Maxwell House published 50 million, but it's one edition, as counts for one. So you know that Maxwell House is the most used Haggadah in the world. This year it hit over 55 million from the time, almost 100 years of that particular Haggadah. But then, as I was preparing for this, I said to myself, let me look a little bit. How many editions of the Tanya alone have been published? And if you know anything about the idea of what we discussed with the Baal Shem Tov a while back in that famous letter of the Baal Shem Tov when he speaks to Mashiach and he says, when are you finally coming? And he says, when you will spread my teachings all around. There's not a place in the world where a Tanya was not published. And we passed, believe it or not, over 5,000 different editions of this particular book. There's not a book in Jewish history that has had so many different editions. When the Israeli army enters anywhere where they haven't been before, I first learned this in 1982, you know, when the Israelis went to Lebanon. As they're going into Lebanon, there's a Chabad truck with the printing press. With the printing press. And they do this all the time. Because they want to print the Tanya in every corner of the world to make sure that all those sparks are redeemed. And when Chassidus is spread to every corner, as the Baal Shem Tov told, Mashiach will come. So if you look a little bit at the handout, the depth of the learning, and this is why people are so scared, and I'll put this in parentheses, of Chabad, because they know how to learn, and they have sources. Really, it's... If you look for a second on the left side of the page, for this week's Parsha, just to give you an idea, here is the Alter Rebbe in Likutei Torah. Likutei Or is the first part. Likutei Torah is from Vayikra and on. So in this week's Parsha, if everyone knows, the Aleph of Vayikra is tiny. So notice immediately, Aleph de Vayikra Zeira, he says. The Aleph of Vayikra is tiny. But in Divrei HaYomim, which is at the end of Tanakh, Ksiv Adam, which is the first word of Divrei HaYomim, Adam is with an Aleph Rabasi. So the Aleph of Vayikra is tiny. The Aleph of Adam, referring to Adam HaRishon at the beginning of Divrei HaYomim, is huge. Ulahavinze, in order to understand why this Aleph is tiny and that Aleph is big, and he just now, just look, just let your eyes glance at the sources that get quoted to answer one tiny question. Why is an Aleph tiny? And as you read through it, goes to the Medrash, to the Zohar, explains so much that is to be explained. And at the end of the day, why should this Aleph, where Moshe is called by Hashem himself, why doesn't Hashem say, identify who he is? Adam needs to be big. Moshe, the calling of Hashem, the Shekhinah itself, is tiny. In answering this question, Rav Shlita Zalman of Liadi develops an idea that is so deep at the end of the day, because he has to deal with Tzimtzum, the idea of contraction, of Hashem contracting into this tiny Aleph. And don't forget, Moshe is the humblest of all human beings. If you remember here, he doesn't even want to write out the word Vayikra, because it says, Hashem called me, how could he call me? Yet here's the greatest of all people who's able to understand that the Shekhinah is able to contract in a way where we as human beings are able to actually perceive it. Adam HaRishon, that needs a large Aleph. That's the beginning of humanity. And goes on, makes a distinction between the physical world and the spiritual world. And starts out with a question about a tiny Aleph. By the time you're finished, pages later, you have now traveled through a tremendous amount of sources. You have to understand step by step what he's trying to build here. And when you're finished, 5-10 pages later, you stand there almost, wow, this was a trip. And if you've traveled it step by step, it changes your life. Because it makes you now think in a different way. And that's the beauty of the Tanya. Because it will explain at the end of the day for every single one of us what's the purpose of every human being? And not for a second to sit there and starve yourself and fasting and serving Hashem. And let me just go there for a minute. During the Middle Ages, there's another group of Hasidim. They were called the Hasidei Ashkenaz. They were led by one of the Baalei Tosfos, Rabbi Yudah Chosid, who wrote a book, Sefer Hasidim. If you remember, this Rabbi Yudah Chosid had a student who eventually becomes famous as the Baal HaRokeach. His name was Rabbi Elazar ben Yehuda, who studies with Rabbi Yudah Chosid, and he writes his own book. When it comes to the concept of tshuva, and part of the Tanya is the Igeres HaTshuva, and the Alter Rebbe makes a big deal out of this, and he quotes and he says, not like the earlier generations who had the idea of tshuvas HaMishkal. What's tshuvas HaMishkal? When you, up until this particular time period, when you did something wrong, you did tshuva. And what was tshuva? You felt bad. At Charata, you did Vidu, you admitted to what you did wrong, and you did Kabbalah Allah, said, I'm not going to do this again, I'll try my best. And that's it, you went on. Hasidei Ashkenaz pushed it one notch up and said, that's not enough. Take every Aveira and do Tshuva Samishkal. Put it on a scale and weigh it. And if the Aveira is pretty serious, then you have to find a physical mode to punish yourself. For example, you ate food which was not kosher. So go through the steps of tshuva, but in addition, you should now fast for 40 days. You can eat early in the morning before sunrise, you can eat after, but during the day for the next 40 days. And if it was a slightly higher sin, then in midst of winter, take the pick or the axe, go to the frozen river, make an opening, and be tovel in the freezing water as a way of doing tshuva. And if it was in midst of summer, take honey and smear it over yourself and let the bees attack. And then you're able to show that you did tshuva. Says Ibshnir Zalman, that's not the way to do tshuva. He totally takes this ideology, which was prevalent for a while, and he, in a very subtle way, says that's not the way we do tshuva. And he intellectualizes the entire concept of tshuva, where the mind begins to understand the power, the negative power of a chait. And the mind understands the positive aspects and the ramifications of doing a mitzvah. And it becomes so much more powerful when you think of it that way. When every person knows at the end of the day there's something called tikkun, and the world needs to be fixed, so to say, by what we do. And what is interesting, again back to the famous Rav Soloveitchik, lovely known as the Rav, who was influenced much by Chabad. In his youth he had a Chabad Malamed. And when you read some of his writings, sometimes you wonder, where did he get this from? And somewhere in passing, Rav Soloveitchik writes the following. Hashem creates an imperfect world. It's our job to make the world perfect. That's classical, totally out of the time. The world has been created by Hashem in such a way where we become partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through this idea of being misakein and make the world a better place. It's our responsibility. So when you think of it that way, and every mitzvah that you do, every word that we say is infused not only with holiness, but with a particular mission. We can make the world better just by saying good morning to someone, by helping someone. And in the opposite, you can destroy worlds. Destroy worlds with one chait, with turning away from a person who needs your help, by not saying good morning and now causing a whole act of friction, like why didn't that person greet me today, and creating. So this book just goes out there and it goes out there, and it becomes like the, what should I call it, that hammer that wakes you up intellectually, but in a very soft way. It doesn't knock you out. It makes you feel good. The amount of people who have returned, so to say, call it Bali Tshuva, people who are inspired through learning Tanya, is greater than any other motivation for doing Tshuva. When you speak to people who have been motivated for something, what turned them on? Because at some point, someone sat down with them and refocused their ideology of what life's all about. And the number one source of taking credit for that, and you can go do a research and you'll see it, is particularly this book. Then there are those sad points in Reb Shneur Zalman's life when, again, our own tell Russian authorities that he was involved in sending money to the enemy in the Ottoman Empire, and he gets arrested, if you remember, and but he gets arrested literally a year after the Tanya was published, which is kind of interesting, because 1797 the book is out there in its abridged form. A year later, around Sukkot time, he gets arrested. And the explanation is that the reason he was arrested, of course, Yutes Kislev is the day of his release, and that becomes a huge Yom Tov, and becomes a Yom Tov L'Chassidus. Why? Because the reason in the upper world for his arrest was understood as a trial for having revealed to the world this new Torah, the Torah of Chassidus. And when he's released, it's almost like the Psak Din was given. This is what needed to happen, and he was vindicated. And lo and behold, the world changes. So when you look at books and you judge books by the impact that they've caused, the impact that the Tanya has caused has not yet been felt. It is an ongoing process that reveals itself literally every day. The beauty of it, on the other side, is that if you speak to any other Hasidic group, the yeshiva world is afraid of it. But in the world of Hasidus in general, take any group of Hasidim, from Ger to Belz to Satmar, this book is learned, and this book is studied. Because you cannot understand Hasidus of any type if you don't go back to this particular book, because it comes with the realm of what the Baal Shem Tov started. So the Torah of earlier Kabbalah, the Arizal, Rabbi Chaim Vital, are very prominent. But in addition, the Torah that the Baal Shem Tov reveals gets encapsulated in here. To end, and I didn't go through any of the sources, you can read them yourself. They're very simple and beautiful. Some come straight out of Tanya. But let me end with an amazing statement. If you remember, we spoke of Rabbi Melech of Luzhansk last time. His brother, Rabbi Zusha, or Zisha, whatever you want to call him, when he saw the Tanya, made a profound statement. And there are many profound statements that were made about it. You can find them. He said he cannot believe that someone was able to take the concept of God, take the concept of Hashem, and collapse it into a tiny book. How could you take the godless Habora, the entire purpose of Bria, of why we're here, and somehow put it in words in a simple book? And that's the beauty of the Tanya. If you read the other writings that he wrote, that's a whole different world. Their sheer simplicity and their depth at the same time are unbelievable. You can take a person, just read, you'll understand something. It makes sense. And then suddenly, the bigger picture falls in, and this entire system of Hasidus, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, fits here, and this fits here, and this fits here. And like, for years you wonder about something that you never wondered about before, like, simple question. is the food that we eat on Shabbos different than the food that we eat during the week? Come on, let's get real. Let's do biological testing and chemicals. The food's the same. But maybe no. Maybe Shabbos brings something different to the food. How does that work? Things like this, like even the clothing that you wear on Shabbos, and you're wearing the exact same suit on Wednesday, and then you put the same suit on Shabbos. Is that the same suit at the end of the day, or somehow because of Shabbos it becomes something else? And Torah HaChassidus will explain that. And we're really, it's again amazing that Hashem Tov comes around, and these great people, everyone produces, and next week, I think it's Wednesday next week instead of Tuesday, we'll speak of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Also a result of all this, with a whole different understanding. So the revolution that the Baal Shem Tov caused suddenly gives, so to say, birth, if you want, to all these new teachings that to this day we're still studying and trying to understand, and now in English it's being translated and commentaries run in 30, 40 volumes to what was one tiny book. So thank you so much for coming, and should be zocher to Biasa Goel, Bakar of Manish, and thank you so much.